When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Did you do anything for New Year's?
Not really. The kid's home from daycare for like two straight weeks,
and right.
Kind of get a little stir crazy, just pretty tired, and not really being able to do much of that. So,
yeah.
Just hung out. It was a good year. You know, it was a good New Year though. It's a lot different when you like have a kid and like you have all this stuff because like, it's just, you have to get like a sitter and you have to do all this stuff in advance to be able to do this. And especially getting one on New Year's Eve is like, you know, almost impossible.
It's just like, whatever.
I'm not doing this shit.
Oh no, I feel that, man. But also a lot of the time I think that like some of the best New Year's, cause like New Year's is so fraught.
Yeah. Right?
Like everyone expects it to be like the best party of the year or whatever, and it can never live up to that and blah blah blah. And it's like a lot of the time I think the best New Year's, like one of my favorite New Year's I always say is that like once Blair and I were back in Seattle visiting and we flew back on the 30th and we were like, oh, that'll give us time. We're like, oh, and then we'll get home, we'll drop our stuff and we're gonna go, and Justin was having a house party, and we're like, and we'll go over to Justin's party. And it was like, no, we were just jet-lagged as hell, and we're completely tired, and we're in bed at, like, 10. I, like, woke up when we heard fireworks, and we're like, Happy New Year. Like, back to sleep. And that's one of my favorite New Year's of all time, was the one where I was asleep. Word on the street is that Justin's party was, like, really incredible, and, like, everyone was having a nice time, and I wasn't there. So, you know, and now our flat is so small that Justin and I can't have house parties, so... Bang. So I missed out on that one. What can I say?
I was gonna ask you a question. Fuck. I don't remember what it was you're talking about.
Yeah.
House part. Oh, staying in.
Staying in.
Yeah, I don't like people just invest New Year's with so much like mental energy. And like, I mean, I understand, like, it's a new year. Like, I mean, even the name is, you know, like, you're going to do that because, I mean, it is, you know, part of the human condition, I believe, that people kind of look to the future with, like, a hope that things will get better, even if, you know, even if they don't have a lot of reason to actually believe that in practice, you know, that's what they do. And so I get that. But at the same time, you know, you're right, because like you have these parties and you're like, oh, you know, New Year sucked. I didn't like meet someone, or I did, you know, like I drank too much and I got hungover and I puked everywhere. You know, but like, you know, if you get fucking wasted, you know, at a Christmas party and puke, I was like, yeah, woo, like, like the year is out. Like,
but
in that 7-day period, we're like, it doesn't matter, because like, you know, a lot of times for a lot of people, you know, in the States, if you don't live near your family, like you might go home and see them for Christmas and like spend time there. And like, if you're doing that, you're like, you know, you're drinking at like your shitty hometown bar, like trying to avoid people you went to high school with or whatever. Then you're like, oh yeah, we went to this field party with this guy I used to know, and we had a great, it was awesome. There was a Christmas tree, you know, and then you're like, you know, a week later, you're like, this is the worst party ever. I can't believe I got wasted at like a nice bar in, you know, Manhattan or LA or, you know, London or wherever the fuck, you know, it's just the same, you know.
Yeah, no, it's funny. Like, real talk. I mean, you should have seen when I lived in Sydney, like, mate, the amount of pressure they put on that because it's hot weather, like hot, although hot weather New Year's whips, which makes up for the fact that hot weather Christmas sucks and it's not good at all. But hot weather New Year's was like such a thing. And it's like, you know, you're like kind of one of the first big cities that has it. And so there was like all this pressure to have like a killer New Year's. And it was just kind of like, I had one that was pretty good. But, you know, it was just kind of like the pressure. And you're like, and that kills it. You're never, the vibe is never going to be right when you're feeling like you have to have fun.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, although I did a really good thing on New Year's Day, which is my mates, I've got some friends who moved over here from Seattle a couple years ago, and they just had people over to their house and made carnitas.
Nice.
And that was, like, really fun. And I was like, now this is a New Year's thing I can get behind, is, like, a big carnitas party. Mm-hmm. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Carnita year.
Yeah, that's right.
The car new year? I don't know.
Car new year. I know. I like that. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Give me. Yeah. Love carnitas.
Love carnitas. Yeah. Hate New Year's Eve. Simple as.
Simple as. It's amazing how many times I say simple as. And like at first my wife was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Because she is the least online person alive.
God bless her. All right.
That tweet about how like one person in a relationship, only one person can be terminally online and the other one has to be normal or whatever. She's the decidedly normal one. And so like I'm just saying simple. I start saying simple as because it's so funny to me. And she's like, what the hell are you talking about? I was like, oh, it's this British thing.
It is.
You know, it's this thing and like chavs say it. And she's like, what's a chav? And I'm like, okay.
All right.
Let's back up here. Okay. So have you heard of the chav squad? You know,
and it's like more specifically Baz's say it, and then you have to explain Baz's.
Oh yeah, see, I don't even know what that is. Yeah, like chav is just the catch-all word that I know. So if that means something,
it's like
else,
a Baz, then... like a Baz is more specifically kind of like a boomer, like an older guy.
Yeah. So, you're right.
Which is where you kind of get the like, don't like it. There's the door.
You're right. And so like I tell her this, and so every time I say simple as, she's like, you have to say it with a British accent. And I'm like, like simple as. I can't
pretend
do
you're
it.
Jason Statham.
One British accent, and that's it. It's Cockney. My sister makes fun of it all the time. Why is it your only accent? I don't know. I'm American. I can't, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I can do RP, but you know, the rest of mine leaves something to be desired, although I can occasionally do a Jason Statham.
I do like the accent that you have in your videos. I do. It's very it's very proper. I'm not making fun of you at all.
No, it's true. Like it exists.
Proper.
That's why I'm laughing, because it's like, it's so funny, because I'll hear myself doing it sometimes, and especially when I'm like around more of my British friends, or if I am in more formal situations, and I don't really control it, but I'm aware of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, it makes total sense. Like, I mean, I don't, you know, I don't use the same vernacular, you know, if I'm doing something that's more formalized than, you know, when I'm talking on the show or whatever, because, you know, you don't talk the same way around everyone. Like, nobody does that. Like,
it's kind of like a form of code switching, I guess.
I think code switching like gets a negative connotation for like the idea that people like some people like really affect an accent or a way of speech that is not native to them, and it sounds ridiculous or whatever. But I mean, code switching is something everyone does. Like, you know, I think I've told the story before. Like, my wife is from South Georgia. When she talks to her sister, she has for a long time, she has a more a more affected Southern accent for a little while, because like that's just, you know, it's just how, like, you know, it's just how you know, how a lot of people talk down there. And you know, it's just the way it is. I find it interesting, because you know, like when I get mad or when I get really worked up, I start to feel like the Southern drawl coming out of me.
I'm like, oh man,
I didn't know that was still in there.
Well, it's funny, because like I just got done spending a bunch of time with my niece and nephew, and my niece is constantly dragging me for this. Like, although she did it less while she was over here, but when I was, like, home visiting in the spring, she's like, Auntie Nora, stop talking with a London accent. I was like, listen here, okay?
Like, you were like, listen here, young lady. Like,
she's got me. She's
See,
got
that
me.
Was the best one I could do. That right there, yeah. 2 seconds, is the best one I could do.
Like,
that's not cocky.
It's, but this is the thing, is that it's just kind of like, you know, in the first place, drag me. You're not wrong. But in the second place,
I'm not misunderstanding. No, I'm not dragging.
I'm saying her.
Like, oh, yeah.
But at the same time, I'm like, you know, I don't control this, babe. Like, and all the time here, everyone always goes, oh, gosh, you've been here so long, and you still have such a strong American accent. And I'm like, no. Didn't have one. I have an American accent. That's it.
I can't guess.
Can't call it strong. I don't think. I mean, like Seattle people don't have strong American accents one way or another.
But you don't even have like a strong accent. You don't even have like a strong like accent for it. Like you know, for someone who has roots in Chicago, like you don't have any, like there's none of that there. So it's like it is. I mean, yeah, I can tell, obviously I know you're American, but like, I can tell you're American, but at the same time, like, you know, like there are also a lot of like English people who, you know, live in America for a long time or, you know, whatever.
And
they kind of, and the Englishness kind of wears off a little bit or something like that. And you start, you know, and so you get this kind of like middle thing in between it. And, yeah, I don't really hear an American accent with you,
Yeah. No. Yeah.
I was trying to think of the Seattle accent, and all I could think of is like the surfer thing from like Southern California. No, that's not it at all. No.
Yeah.
You guys need to have a. But you're touching Canada, so it's you should have like this insanely like you should have this weird thing like what they have in like Minnesota.
Yeah.
You have like Midwest and Canada.
Yeah, it's just I think it's like a West Coast thing. I think people just kind of like got there too late. And there are like Seattle things like Northwestern things that you'll occasionally get where it'll be like they're quite annoying. Like it'll be people will say beg instead of bag and things like that, but I just don't I got that. So, yeah. But
yeah. All right, you
I'm so ready to talk about heresy at all times. So
all right. 3, 2, 1 Hello, and welcome back to We're Not So Different, a podcast about how we've always been idiots. Happy 2023, and I think, is it the 10th day of Christmas? Is that what it is today?
It is. It's actually the 11th day of Christmas.
So you're entitled to probably birds of some kind.
I think we're into people dancing.
It's
like, is it Lords a Leaping? Like
I think it's like one
of those like you get things. I'm looking it up. She's looking it up, folks, because nobody knows after it. Oh, it's Piper's Piping. Homies. Yes.
There you go. So yeah. So today you should be celebrating the 11th day of Christmas. You should be expecting 11 Piper's Piping, and if your true love does not give that to you, well. Maybe they're not your true love after all. I'm just kidding, of course. Nobody wants to hear Piper's Piping, you know, if they weren't ready for it. Anyway, we're talking about more heresies today. And also, you know, here to have a happy new year and wish one to y'all as well. Before we get started, though, we have a question from one of our patrons, Desha, who asked, when cults are talked about in the modern day, there's a big focus on quote-unquote indoctrination and how people are taken advantage of. Were there similar things in medieval Europe when Catholics talked about heresies, or was the focus more on blaming participants, not really the leaders? So I guess what Desha's asking here is, you know, like, you know, did they recognize like manipulation tactics and stuff like that? You know, were the heresies, I guess, trying to be treated like cults?
Yeah.
Culturally.
I think this is a really interesting question because it just kind of like made me think about, interestingly, like individualism a lot, because, you know, one of the big things that gets bandied about is that medieval people don't have a sense of the individual and they only kind of see themselves as groups. But I think that really, when you start looking at the way that heretics are treated, that isn't the way that that they tend to treat things. And there is there is kind of like a lot more put on personal responsibility for these things. But having said that, within it, there is a hierarchy, right? So you are worse if you're Jan Hus than if you're a Hussite, right? Because it's worse to come up with a heresy. That's why you got killed at the stake or whatever. But you still made a decision to follow Jan Hus, is kind of like how it's looked at. Having said that, you know, there are also kind of these outliers. You know, I'm always talking about, for example, with the good men and women of Languedoc, there is Beatrice, who she basically like becomes a heretic, but it's mostly because she's like screwing a bunch of guys, which is adorable. And I kind of love that for her. So
love a good heresy.
I absolutely love a good heresy. What can I say? So like she kind of like gets put on trial for being a heretic because she is one or whatever, but it becomes incredibly clear to everyone that like, they're just kind of like, ah, girl, what are you doing? Like, so she doesn't get killed or anything like that. They're just like, knock it off. With it.
Hey, whoa, come on. What are you doing?
Yeah,
here?
Like, because basically she was like talked into it by like a couple of dudes who wanted to bang her, and she was like, dang, well, I guess when you put it that way, but like, you know, there isn't like the same thing about like she was indoctrinated. It's more like, girl, you were so stupid. Like, they don't go, oh, it was like against her. There's this idea that you could have at any point in time been like, no. But at the same time, there is this sort of like, ugh, she's obviously less culpable because like a couple of dudes were like, actually, the real sin is if you don't bang me. And she's like, wow, you make a great point. I guess I'm a heretic now. And, it, you know, so there is kind of like some understanding that people kind of get in over their heads and they're just like not particularly with it. But there isn't the same idea of indoctrination. There isn't the same idea of a psychological process because there isn't an idea of psychology.
Right.
But you do within this interestingly see that there is some premium put on, you know, ideas of individual culpability for one's own spiritual actions, which is ironic because like especially in like the later heresies, that is like one of the big things that you see over and over again is this idea that like, well, maybe you're kind of responsible for your salvation more than just like the church as a whole. So it's quite funny that, you know, that kind of gets brought up as like, well, this is your fault if you do the wrong thing. But otherwise it's like, oh, but if anything good happens, it kind of happens more through the established hierarchy of the church. But I mean, it makes perfect sense that they wouldn't have a real understanding of this if you get my drift, because they just don't think about the mind in the same way that we do. So there is no real way to kind of think about that. But it's an incredibly interesting question for that reason, because it's like, well, how does our society see things as opposed to theirs? And how do we look at these issues of like culpability? Yeah. So I love this question. I really liked it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Well, Desha, thank you so much for the question. And if you want to ask us questions like that, that we will answer here on the show, then please subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/WNSDpod. $5 a month, you can get access to all of these episodes ad-free. You can get access to our 30 bonus episodes, and you will get access to our live stream of our review of A Knight's Tale, which we are going to be doing sometime next week, probably on the YouTube channel. We will let you know, of course, let patrons know when we're going to do that so you can listen in. And you can check us out, you know, check out how we normally do an episode, ask us questions that we'll, you know, answer there. And yeah, and then obviously we'll repost it for anyone who can't make it, because it'll probably be, you know, early in the day for people in America, you know, because of time zones. That's just kind of how it works sometimes. So yeah, we'll get to all that next week. And, yeah, if you become a patron, you will have access as well. So do that. And, I'm going to watch A Knight's Tale and get hyped to talk about medieval hijinks.
Yeah, I'm incredibly stoked for that one. Can't wait.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah. Yay. And then also, you may have noticed, or you may not have, we are coming up on our 100th episode. This one right here is number 96. So we've only got about three more, and then we'll be there. And for our 100th episode, we are actually just opening it up to everyone, and we are going to answer questions about the show, about, you know, how we record it, our process that goes into it. You know, questions about us, things we like, things we don't like, you know, recommendations, all that sort of stuff. You know, general questions, conspiracy theories, all that sort of stuff. Just nothing about the Middle Ages. We will not be answering questions about the Middle Ages for one episode only. But yeah, we will, by the time this episode is posted, there will be a question thread on our Twitter account where you can ask us those questions. You can, you know, check, you can DM us on the Patreon. You can DM us on Twitter. You can send an email, WNSDpod@gmail.com, I think is what it is. Yeah. You know, and we'll answer them, and we'll have a good show. And yeah, if you don't ask us enough questions, then I will be forced to go on long diatribes about things that everyone but me has. And nobody wants that. I'll do it. I swear to God, I'll talk to you about.
Send us your questions.
25 minutes. Send us questions if you do not want to hear me talk about what's something that I hyperfixate on? The Tunguska event.
Oh,
flattened a bunch of trees in Russia.
Mate, I love the Tunguska event though.
It's so awesome.
I do, man. Yeah.
it killed 800,000 trees.
Yeah, I mean,
that's insane.
Maybe it just was an event where the Earth was like, "Don't like them trees."
Oh man, gotta that's get
rid
rough. Of
getting rid.
That's rough. Yeah, but yeah, episode 100. Send us questions, or you will be subjected to boring hyperfixations that I have, and I'll get real boring with it. Don't get me wrong. Yeah, but anyway, on to the show, on to these heresies. So we took a break for the holidays, but it's time to end all the loafing around and get back to our series on heresies against the medieval church. In our last episode of the series, we had something of a grab bag of various heresies. Verices, I guess, to cover, including the good men of Languedoc, the Waldensians, Henricians, and the various so-called crusades against Christians. Despite being called crusades, these appear to have largely been imperialist ventures undertaken to expand the church's temporal power, or done by secular rulers meant to do land grabs and resource grabs, or enforce rigid social hierarchies of the time. By now in our series, you might be noticing something of a trend. As the Catholic Church gains increasing power, it continues grasping for even more. Not content to hold overwhelming spiritual authority, it turns scattered church lands into, well, a Holy Roman Empire, actual contiguous physical empire stretching across the whole of Central Europe. It further sought to control politics across the entire continent, getting involved in dynastic affairs, playing kingmaker, and generally using the power of excommunication from God and heaven as a cudgel to get its way. The church's power was even such that it was able to overawe the secular power of the Holy Roman Emperors themselves during the investiture controversy, which we didn't even mention last time, mostly because it wasn't really a heresy, but it was ongoing in the background. Yes, the church's power was vast, though not yet at its zenith, because they still have to take the show on the road and Christianize two new continents via genocide. But even so, cracks were appearing in the foundation. There are, of course, more minor heresies to be combated, like the free spirits, who we will discuss. But even bigger cracks began to form, and formerly internal disputes like investiture became fissures that broke open the church, eventually leading to the Avignon papacy and a host of antipopes. Then we will see the first of what we might recognize as reformers crop up with John Wycliffe, his vernacular Bible, and the Lollards. And who boy is that vernacular Bible thing not going away anytime soon. Oh, and Europe is going to be demolished by the Black Death, which kills anywhere from 15 to 40% of the world's population, and that will truly undermine the church's temporal and spiritual authority in undeniable ways that they could never have anticipated. And just so you're clear, if we don't get to all of this, yeah, just pretend like I didn't say that stuff about Wycliffe and the Bible, and we'll come back to it next time.
Yeah, I mean, real talk, yeah.
Yep, just for reference, this episode will cover the years from about 1250 AD to about 1400. You should know that the papal inquisitions are ongoing and have been since the 1230s. They'll continue through this episode, but we'll talk about it next time when we get to their most famous victim, Joan of Arc. Today, we'll start with a few quick hitters on the comparatively minor but in no way less important heresies that get to the existential shit.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Eleanor.
Yes.
I'm tired of talking, and I shouldn't talk that long. What are the Brethren of the Free Spirit?
Okay.
What are these guys all about?
So this is a really interesting one because we don't know that much, because this is one of these ones where it's like, where we're doing a lot of it based on vibes, okay? So, like, the thing about the Brethren of the Free Spirit is they're somewhat big in kind of, like, northern Europe. So, like, the lowlands, places like that, parts of Germany, but also in Bohemia, so which is nice. So this is cool. We kind of see them crop up a bit in, like, kind of, like, the 13th and century, and then they kind of hang out until about the 5th century. But they're around in northern Italy. They're in, you know, these places that interestingly are like wealthy, well connected, and in the Holy Roman Empire. That's where you see the Brethren of the Free Spirit. And what we know about them, we know from Albertus Magnus. Okay, so Albertus Magnus writes this text, which is called A Compilatio de Novo Spiritu, in 1202, but when he writes it, it's kind of limited to Swabia, which is part of the German-speaking lands, okay? So, that is, like, all well and good, but, like, the point of it is that, like, we don't necessarily know if all the people who are accused of this really believe in it, right? So, basically, what he says about it is that it's got certain themes, right? There are certain things within it that, like, the free spirits believe in. And the first one is what is called autotheism. Okay. And autotheism is an important thing to have a think about because it's going to come up a lot in this episode. And basically, it's this idea that when one is holy, one's soul becomes, like, subsumed into God. So, like, a perfected soul will then become one with God over, like, eventually, to the point where there is kind of, like, annihilation of the self, right? And in particular, this annihilation of the self or annihilation of the individual soul is one of the issues that the church has with them. Because, basically, this calls into question the separation that occurs between humans as the fallen and the creator, right? You will note also that this, it comes up a lot kind of in Eastern religions. So this kind of idea about, like, the soul becoming, you know, if one, for example, graduates from samsara in Buddhism, then the soul kind of, like, is annihilated in the same way. This is a big part of it. So that's autotheism. The other big bits are kind of like denial of things that the church likes, which is to say the necessity of the sacraments, the church itself, and also Christ. So that's a problem, because the idea here is that, you know, Christ is a good guy, but think of him more like a bodhisattva, like, you know, or like that's a good guy. But, like, basically, if you live an ascetic life, and you are in communion with the Holy Spirit properly, then you can communicate directly with God.
Hmm.
And so you're not going to, you don't need the intercession of, like, of the Christological figure. Now, whether or not that is Albertus Magnus, just give, like, given at large, you know, or that, that the thing about Christ is true, we don't really, really know. Now, my favorite bit is that they do be talking about Jesus in a very sexy way.
Nice.
So, like, a big thing is, like, this is often referred to as an erotic union. Is a way. So it's kind of like when they talk about Jesus, they're like, yeah, and then we made out, and, you know, and it's kind of like, it's like incredibly sexual. But having said that, you get a lot of incredibly sexual writing about Christ in general.
Yeah. So, I think you talked about that. So
It be happening, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is the point, right? The other thing is that you get antinomianism. Antinomianism is this idea that, like, so you are kind of, you can be incapable of sin if you are truly divine, right? Okay, so this often comes from in interpretation of Galatians 5:18. Which says, those who are driven or led by the Spirit of God are no longer under the law.
Yeah.
Okay, so so if you really are in communion with God, which they claim to be, then you can't really sin. So there is a kind of axiom that is brought up about this, which is nothing is a sin except what is thought to be a sin. So, like... basically, it's like, you know, you determine what sinfulness is. Obviously, the church hates that. not big on that.
Not big on everything that happens outside of without my consent happens.
Yeah exactly. And then basically, then there's also, like, your bog standard anti-clerical sentiment. So, like, you know, screw priests.
Yeah.
The Pope is bad. Which I'm like, I agree. So, you know, not bad at all. But this is kind of like a really loose, like, it's not like, there isn't kind of like a necessarily like a group of people who you can say, oh, here's the Brethren of the Free Spirit. And this kind of just will get brought up over and over again when you find any group of people between kind of the 13th and the 15th century who are just kind of being a bit thingy.
Yeah.
Then suddenly they're like, "Ah, well, we hate this," you know. And you're doing like the heresy of the Brethren of the Free Spirit. I can see what you're up to, kind of deal. This is one of those ones where you just kind of have to be really, really careful with it, because within this, it's possible, that people are doing heretical things, but it's also possible that, you know, when the church gets their hands on things, they have this tendency to kind of like make everything into a well-founded theology that has like specific tenets or whatever, because like that's what they're working with, right? So they tend to be like, aha, you know, like this is what's going on, so like we have to necessarily like put a stop to it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's so. It can just be actually that sorry, my doorbell keeps ringing. I'm going to fucking lose my mind. But also, like, it could just be that this is, like, them reflecting their own understanding of how religion works in the world. So we have to just kind of take these things with a grain of salt, right?
Yeah, that makes sense, they were condemned at the Council of Vienne.
Yeah.
Vienne.
Yeah, Vienne, I think. It might 1311. Be Vienne, actually. It might be Vienne. I take it back. Vienne. Yeah.
Condemned in 1311. Same council. They covered a lot of. They covered.
Oh,
a lot
they
here.
Do.
They, they got the Beguines and the Beguards, and they withdrew to support from the Templars, which is something we'll talk about a little bit more in just a second.
I mean, they do some good things, which is like, well, I mean, actually, is it good? I don't know. But they also like that. Like, this council is also like, and priests, I'm begging you to stop having concubines. Oh my God, please knock it off, which is fair enough. But a lot of it is just kind of like, you're all heretics, and, you know, we'll get into that more. So, yeah, Council of Vienne.
Yeah.
Real fun. Yeah.
Yep. So after the Free Spirits, we come to the Beguines and the Beggards and, of course, Margaret Poirot.
Yeah.
Poirot. Oh.
So, okay. Beguines and Beggards. This is where we got to start. Right. Mm. And so Beguines are like the women and Beggards are the men. And they are essentially a lay clerical order. Mm. So what they kind of are doing is very similar things to what Franciscans or Dominicans are doing, where they are a group of people who are super, super devoted to lay piety, but they want to work with communities, right? Mm-hmm. So they are most specifically really active in kind of like the lowlands. It's everything happens in the lowlands, I swear to God. they're super, super active in the lowlands for a start. And they live together in groups. So the Beguines, which is like the women, live together in what we call Beguinages, which is just a fun word to say, so I like saying it. Mm-hmm. And they preach, they administer to the poor, and they kind of live one of these lives where they're like, you know, everything needs to be, you need to kind of like, you need to be focusing on apostolic poverty. So that is all well and good, except the church hates that. Okay. And now the church hates this for several reasons. In the first place, there's no rule here, right? So this is just a bunch of people who are just doing whatever it is they want. In the second place, these are lay people and they take a really dim view specifically of lay people preaching. They don't like that.
Right.
So like no going around and preaching for you because like, how do you know? Right? Mm-hmm. Like, no one is overseeing you, if there isn't some form of clerical oversight, then who knows what it is that you're telling people? So this is kind of like a specifically difficult point. They're not actually within the church, but they're kind of like usurping what the church sees as its own rightful role, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. So that's what they're doing. Although to you and I, it's kind of like, well, I don't know. They seem kind of like genuinely spiritual and like that's where it goes. Now, the thing about Beguines though, is that they're not always disliked. We have kind of like there's an early saint, from the 12th century who's, Saint Marie de, I guess it's, we, I cannot pronounce everything. De Wina? I think O-I-G-I-N-E-S. Mm. Fuck you, French.
As always, fuck you, French.
Once per show, fuck you, French. I can't speak it. So she becomes a saint, and she's kind of around from the late 12th century to the early 13th century. And we know about her because she has a biographer, Jacques de Vitry, and he is a theologian and a canonist. And he writes all about her life and, you know, which is basically how she eventually becomes a saint. Marie had originally gone to Jacques and been like, I think that you should take up preaching. But he becomes really inspired by her. He goes on and on about her because she is from a kind of rich family. But she is really dedicated to, in his words, she wishes to work with her hands in order to afflict her body through penance and also furnish life's necessities for those in need. So she does manual labor, and she is like trying to give things to the poor. So she kind of like gets into all this because even though she grew up rich, she marries a poor guy, and her parents are don't support this. So she's kind of like, oh yeah, well screw you, mom and dad. If you don't like that, you're gonna really hate it when I kind of take up with a borderline. heretical group. So she would do all kinds of like really weird devout stuff in the way that religious people who were gunning for a sainthood would do. So she would like sleep on wooden planks with a rope tied around her like belly so that she couldn't sleep. She was constantly fasting. She wouldn't eat meat. She apparently ate bread that was so stale that it would cut her mouth open. And then she and her husband eventually decide that they are going to be chaste. Her husband goes along with this. This is super common from like religious married couples. You see that a lot. So basically then she and her husband start working more specifically with people with leprosy. And Marie has, you know, divine visions, and apparently she has healing powers. Like, she, like, can cure the sick by giving them locks of her hair, right? And,
damn.
And she becomes a saint, right? And she becomes a saint, yeah. And there you go. That's Saint Marie de Wien, maybe?
Yep.
Yeah, Wien-y? I don't know.
Yep.
Like, you know, so there you go. So there's one, right? So compare and contrast that with Marguerite Porret. Okay, so Marguerite Porret, a little bit later. So she is kind of like, she is put on trial for heresy in 1310, so kind of 14th century. Mm-hmm. And she writes this book that is called The Mirror of Simple Souls. And it's kind of cool in a lot of ways. She thinks a lot about the concept of what we call agape, or universal love. It's like one of the several Greek ways of thinking about the concept of love. It's written in French, and not in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And it describes that upon death, the like corrected souls pass through seven stages of what she calls annihilation, and then are eventually subsumed into oneness with God. And she considers God to be, basically a concept of love in general. Mm-hmm. So she wrote of this in The Mirror of Simple Souls. The quote is, "I am God, says love, for love is God, and God is love, and the soul is God by the condition of love. I am God by divine nature, and this soul is God by righteousness of love." Okay, so do you see what she's doing there? So it's like, if one is involved in the act of perfect love, then one becomes divine in and of themselves, and it's kind of like a self-fulfilling kind of like thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, this did not go down well.
Shocking.
So basically, the Bishop of Cambrai orders that all copies of The Mirror of Simple Souls be burnt. She's put on trial for heresy in 1310. A Dominican friar, William of Paris, has her burnt at the stake. And this is kind of like a big French thing. So now there's a couple things going on here where it's like, I think that Marie was over in the lowlands as opposed to like in France writ large, right? So there's kind of like less of, this kind of like driving, you know, like the Council of Vienne is like this kind of French going on, right? So there's kind of like less of a driving force over in the lowlands for it. But also like Marie is acting this out in, you know, the expected ways of a saint. As I say, it's just, this is bog standard. It's like, yeah, cut your mouth on bread. You don't sleep. You're working with the lepers. Yeah, okay, great. You know, like that's, you know, we expect to kind of see these things. Marguerite, on the other hand, is advancing new theological ways of considering the soul. And the church cannot be having that. Right.
You hate to see it. Yeah. You hate to see the church sniffing out an independent woman.
I know, like she's just trying to girl boss, right? So
yeah.
I guess this is the thing that again we have to be really, really careful when we talk about Beguines, because there's Beguines and there's Beguines. And you know, Beguinages like still exist in the lowlands. Like you can
Right.
Like, you know, like they're not condemned or whatever if you're doing things kind of like by the book.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's just kind of about policing these lines, but you know, basically Marguerite Porret is exactly what the church wants to stop from happening, because it's like, well, here's this, she's just completely out of pocket, right? Where it's just like, what are you talking about? No, you can't tell people that. And the fear is that if you allow laity to start preaching, they'll start just saying stuff like this, which goes against like church doctrine and teaching. So, you know, it's possible to be a Beguine and stay on the right side of the law, but it also happens that they don't. And a lot of people take a dim view of them. Like, my boy Milich doesn't like them.
Hurtful.
I know, where I do like them. But, like, yeah, he says in, like, one of his letters to the Pope, where he's, like, begging the Pope to come back to Rome, he says that, like, the whole world is full of beggars. It's filling up with beggars and Beguines, and there's no one to stop them.
No. God,
what? No. And I'm like,
not
buddy,
no people buddy. Are helping other people.
This MF-er is incredibly like running and off the books, like, you know, like nunnery of his own anyway. So, but he's like, but he's like, it's okay when I do it. So you're just like, okay, buddy.
Yeah. He's running the,
yeah, he's like, he's running
he's
the,
he's running an off the books nunnery. That's great.
he was.
OTB nunnery. Gonna bet on who's gonna be the holiest this year.
Yeah, and see absolutely.
If I can get some good odds. Yeah.
Yeah.
Will Margaret Poirot be burned this year?
I could get into that.
Yes, plus 1-6. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So. Yeah, that's awesome. I like the whole annihilation of the soul concept.
Yeah.
I think that is.
It's really
very
appealing,
interesting.
Right?
Yeah, it is. Like, I think, you know, it's a very interesting way. You know, like. Even if you know the body withers away, you know the soul is still preserved in some aspect in, like, you know, the consciousness of Earth or God or you know whatever you want to call that, and that's pretty cool to the spiritual part of me that still exists. Yeah, it's still in there, just beaten down into a pulp. So after that, we come to the Fraticelli, so-called spiritual Franciscans.
Yeah, and yeah.
They're mad about something.
Yeah, they're very mad. So, okay, basically, the Fraticelli are mad because they don't like that there were changes made to the initial rule of St. Francis. So kind of like the Franciscans sort of like one of the last orders that's kind of like let in the doors the medieval period, where they're like, you know, because you see what's going on the streets. You see your Marguerite Poirets, etc., running around. And, you know, St. Francis could have been seen as, you know, a challenge to the church. But instead, the church kind of understood what side its bread was buttered on. They're like, yeah, we should probably get some poor guys in. Because Lord knows the Pope ain't going to live poor. So, like, let's get some poor guys in to show everyone that, like, yeah, we get it. So, anyway. And Franciscans are supposed to be living up to the conception of apostolic poverty. And the idea here is that when Jesus, like, was going around doing his thing, picking up the apostles, he was just like, come with me. And they're like, oh, okay, word. And then they just walked off.
Yeah.
Right? And then they, like, and things just kind of... were made available to them through the greatness of God to see the miracle of loaves and fishes for, you know, more information, things of this nature, right? So
see the Gospels et al.
Exactly. And so, like, they're supposed to be wearing sandals and, like, brown robes that are cheap, and their role in society, which is what is innovative about them and the other begging orders, is that they actually work with people. So they're out preaching in the world as opposed to being cloistered. And so this is what the Fraticelli are into. Okay, so, but what begins to happen as time goes on is suddenly you've got, like, old Franciscans, right? And it's like, well, they can't go around preaching, so what are we supposed to do with them? You know, people give them donations. So money is starting to kind of, like, so a need for money. Is kind of coming on the one hand. And on the other, there is also, like, more money coming along. And they're like, what are we going to do with all of this? So there is a conception that has come up with to kind of get around this theologically, which is that you need to understand that the Franciscans are given gifts or money or what have you in exchange for their services as preachers, or for, in extreme circumstances, also giving the sacraments out. There's a lot of kind of back and forth about whether they should be giving the sacraments out, but that's a 14th century theological debate for another time. So basically, the popes say, okay, well, yeah, the way that you need to think about this is a gift exchange. You're giving the gift of, you know, religious services, you're giving the gift of preaching, and in return, money is given, or, you know, lands are given, or whatever. And it's not you collecting money in the same way that the church writ large does. It's a gift exchange, and that makes it okay for you guys to hold property. The Fraticelli oppose this. And they are initially referred to as the Zelanti. And so, like, there are those who kind of, like, are like, oh, yeah, hey, look, we got a monastery now, and we're living in here, and we're taking care of the old guys. So we go out to preach, and then we go back in the monastery at night. And the Zelante are like, fuck no, we're out in the community, we're doing our things, we're running around, and this is just kind of how we're living our life, and we're going to keep doing this. We feel that holding property at the level where you have houses, you have monasteries, and is like, it's antithetical to being a Franciscan, one way or another. That view is then declared heretical by Boniface VIII in 1296. And he's all like, shut the fuck up and get in your monastery, basically. And basically, you know, it's one of these things where it's kind of making them look bad, I guess. It's kind of like one way of looking at it. Now, Boniface VIII, though, remember this name, because... it's about to come up again, because Boniface VIII is like a noted shut the fuck up and do what I say Pope, which doesn't necessarily go down well for him. Now, there were some noted dudes among the Fraticelli, my favorite being Angelo Di Clarino, who kind of has a series of followers. So basically, they got condemned around 1278 for... you know, doing their thing. They're condemned to imprisonment for life. But the general of their order then frees them. And they, like, they skive off to Armenia, where they're like, we're out, we're going to Armenia. And the king over there is Hethum II. He's like, come on in, like, come on in, come in, bros. Like, I love this. But the local clergy are like, I am not particularly... excited about this, because like all these like random Italians have just shown up, and like they are gonna like there's like a worry that essentially them as kind of like these apostolic poverty guys is gonna reflect badly on the local clergy essentially, so they then get exiled from Armenia in about 1293, and like they kind of like are then allowed back into Italy when Celestine V is like into this sort of thing. So they're like, oh, this will be fine. And he was all like, oh, yeah, like, do your, like, hermit thing. Love that. Like, absolutely fine. I'm going to absolve your vows of obedience to, like, any Franciscan superiors. We're going to just talk about you as a separate group of people. And you could, like, stay at Celestine monasteries. But then he abdicates. And... and then that's when Boniface VIII comes in, right? And so, like, that's the issue. So, like, basically, like, they then say, okay, well, we're gonna go to Greece, and we're gonna go to Greece, and we don't think that the Pope should be allowed to do this. Basically, unfortunately for them, like, Boniface manages to. Convince the Patriarch of Constantinople to go after them. They kind of like bounce around. They're like going to Thessaly. They're kind of like running around. And like, but I kind of like just love them because they're like these vagabond guys. I just think it's cool how they're just like running around all over the place. And I think they're cool to talk about because it shows you how interconnected Christendom is in the medieval period, where it's like you could just show up in Armenia, then you're back in Italy, and now you're over, and you know, you can move around. And it also shows how savvy groups of people are, where it's like, you know, these guys have a real understanding of how the church works and also how, like, power on earth works, and they play that really well to their own advantage and manage to move around. But, yeah, like, the Fraticelli are an interesting one because, in theory, there's nothing wrong with what they want. And, indeed, it was at one point in time said that this was fine by the church, but enough time had passed by this point where they're like, no. So yeah, but there's some cool dudes who rock. I think Angelo Di Clarino is a cool guy. He rocks. Like, what can I say?
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, and our final quick hitter here is just one I'll take real quick. It's the purging of the Templars from France in 1307 by Philip IV. Of France. Philip's meddling in the papacy eventually led to the election of Pope Clement V in 1305 and 1307 in order to get out from under debts owed to the Templars. Philip induced Clement to label the Templars as heretics, despite the church never really trying them for their crimes. And Philip had his soldiers mercilessly hunt the Templars down and execute them for heresy. The last of them, Jacques de Molay, is finally caught and burned to the stake a few years later. Oh, there's an appearance by my wife in the background.
Yeah, sorry, I'm doing like a silent wife waving. Sorry,
no,
everybody.
That's great. No, nobody cares to hear me rattle on about this.
Everybody cares about the Templars. Are you joking? Well, this is like
the purging of the Templars is important for two reasons. The first and obviously most important is it seems to serve as the basis for the events of Order 66, which is a plot point in the Star Wars franchise, which I care about. But really, the reason we're here is that finally in 1309, Clement found Rome to be hostile to him and moved his curia to Avignon, France, which begins Avignon papacy and the anti-popes. And we'll start with a question from our patron Alan S. Can we have an episode on the anti-popes? No, you can't, Alan, but you can have this section on it.
There's so Eleanor, many anti-popes.
So many of them. The first one's actually from like 100 AD, which I didn't know until doing this, which is cool. Anti-popes in, I guess, the late Middle Ages. Before we get to Avignon, Eleanor, anti-popes in the Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah, okay, so this is like a vibe. Like, the anti-popes in Holy Roman Empire are such a thing because of the imperial-papal rivalry, right? So because there's always this thing where, you know, the popes are like, we're the ones who give emperors power, and the emperors are like, you absolutely do not. Shut the fuck up. Like, it basically breeds a system where it encourages anti-popes to kind of, like, come about. So there are kind of, like, even between the 11th and 14th centuries, like, before we get to the Avignon papacy, you got about 9 of them, okay? Mm-hmm. Frederick Barbarossa, in particular, is a big one for anti-popes, mostly because he is doing a lot of kind of like war in Sicily, more specifically. And like, so he's attempting to kind of like take particular lands that he believes are his dominion. And the papal legates are like, could you please stop doing so much war next to us? And he's like, no.
No.
I absolutely will not. And then the popes will occasionally be like, okay, well, we're excommunicating you. And he's like, the fuck you are. When popes will die, like, so basically when Pope Adrian IV dies in 1159, two rival popes get elected. This happens a lot. And so Barbarossa is like, okay, word. They're both like, hey, but you're going to support me as the pope, right? Which, again, shows you that, like, the papal imperial rivalry. It's like, oh, popes make emperors, but sometimes emperors make popes, so whatever. Frederick is kind of like busy. He's like at war, and he's like, okay, well, look, he says to Alexander III, who's like one of the guys, like, why don't you come and come to me and chat to me about what's going on, and then like I'll but you're going to have to like accept my imperial decrees about what's happening with this wars. And Alex is like, no. And so Frederick is like, okay, well, it's Victor. It's Victor IV, everybody. And he's going to be the pope. So Alexander then immediately, like, excommunicates Victor and Frederick, obviously. And he tries to kind of, like, get a council together with, like, the French king, like, to decide who should be pope. And, you know, things like this. So basically stuff like this just keeps happening. So it's like over and over and over again, like, someone dies, you know, Frederick will be like, who's supporting me? When someone says yes and someone says no, he's like, okay, the one who says yes. Now, my favorite anti-pope is made by Louis the Bavarian, or Ludwig, as I like to call him, because it's more fun to say Ludwig, and that's also his name. But he basically gets made because it's Nicholas V is his anti-pope. And he basically gets made because he is, like, Ludwig is in conflict with the pope, which is, I think, Pope John XXII. Yes, I know this. Who's one of the Avignonese popes. Basically what has kind of happened is that, like, Ludwig is just kind of like, again, completely out of pocket. He's not listening to anyone. He's rampaging around, like, won't listen to the Pope, won't do anything. And then people are like, we got to get rid of this, this guy. And this is around when, we start to see kind of like rumblings of getting Charles IV into power. And they're like, okay, you know what? We're going to do a do-over for like, so they excommunicate Ludwig, and then they're like, we're doing a do-over for the Holy Roman Imperial election. And, like, lo and behold, like, the church and Charles IV's dad supports him. Which is very funny. But it's also very funny because at the time you were supposed to only have to have, you were supposed to have all seven imperial electors, and Charles then tries to change it later, and the church is like, no. And it's like, dude, what did we do? Anyway. So anyway, Ludwig takes a really dim view of all of this, right? And he's like, oh yeah, I'm making my own pope. And he makes Nicholas V. And he was a Franciscan, was anti-Pope Nicholas V. And Nicholas V is all like, yeah, like, fuck all, like, the Avignon papacy, and I'm with my homeboy here, and me and all my homies hate Avignon, and, you know, the things of this nature. But no one really takes it seriously because, like, that is, like, you know, the whole thing was very, like, what are we going to do about this entire thing? No one really takes Nicholas V seriously. And then eventually, like, Charles and Ludwig are going to have a war about it, but then Ludwig has a stroke on a bear hunt and dies. And everyone is like, well, I guess Charles is the emperor then.
Well, that settles that.
Basically. So,
just dust off our hands and go home.
Yeah, pretty much. It's quite funny, right? So, you know, these are the kind of reasons that you have anti-popes crop up during the Holy Roman Empire is basically they come about because if popes are impeding what it is that, you know, the emperor wants to do, then, you know, obviously the emperor sometimes will just be like, I'm making a whole new pope. But sometimes it's just about, like, the fact that oftentimes papal elections are contested. It's not, you know, now you expect them to be easy and everyone expects them to kind of, like, go that way. But that's just not how it goes down, in especially kind of like the high to late medieval period. It can be really, really easily contested. There are a lot of politics at play, and that is how you end up getting anti-popes then. But this is slightly different from just like the Avignon papacy writ large, which I think is, you know, not all Avignonese popes are anti-popes. Just keep that in mind, I suppose. Because, you know, when we're talking about Nicholas V here, he's in opposition to an Avignonese pope. John 22nd is Avignonese, right? And that's fine. My favorite pope, Pope Urban V, was Avignonese, and he was just a pope, you know? It's, you get to the anti-popes later, but yeah.
And that leads us into Avignon. So what was the Avignon papacy, and how did the stuff we've talked about, the heretical movements we've talked about so far, kind of lead into it?
Mate, the Avignon papacy is so good. I love the Avignon papacy. I'm team Avignon all the way. I think it's good. I like the papal palace in Avignon. No notes. Great time. Love this. Okay, so basically, the Avignon papacy lasts from about 1309 to 1376. Okay, like the papacy itself, which is not necessarily the schism, right? And you get seven popes who live in Avignon. Avignon at the time is not necessarily French. It's in the Kingdom of Arles. And Arles is part of the Holy Roman Empire at the time, which, you know, standard Holy Roman procedure, right? So basically, this starts off because of a conflict between the French crown and the popes. So, Philip IV of France, who is the one who is all like, I think that we shouldn't have Templars, right? he is kind of like, he's doing some kind of like things that now we kind of like are like, oh, this is sort of like nascent nationalism. And among them, what he wanted to do was he wanted to be able to collect taxes from clergy members in France. And Pope Boniface VIII is Pope by now, and he's like, what, are you fucking serious? Like, why would I let you do that? I'm absolutely not going to allow that to happen. And you know, basically, like, this kind of keeps going on so Pope Boniface VIII eventually dies, RIP to a real piece of shit. But, you know, like, Pope Boniface VIII, you know, during the Council of Vienne, you know, he is, you know, he does these things. Like, you know, he does go after the Knights Templar, but then there's, like, this line, right, of when, you know, where he kind of, like, says that things are too much, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, part of the thing that kind of goes down is that during the Council of Vienne, they want to do another crusade. Mm-hmm. So, like, basically, the kings of Aragon are like, can you please attack Granada? And then kind of like, and like the Armenians are like, and also can we attack the Holy Land again? Because I'd like more things. And so basically the Boniface tries to get Philip to like say that he will go on crusades sometime within the next 6 years. Then there's like a new Pope, Clement, who's involved, and Clement is like, I think you should begin within 1 year. Standard stuff, right? Okay. So, and then we get a new Pope after Boniface VIII, and that is Pope Benedict XI. Mm. God bless him. So, what happens with Pope Benedict XI? It's that he gets beat up, okay? this is what happens, is that he gets beat up. So he gets elected, and basically the reason why he kind of gets elected is that he is seen as he's going to be somewhat friendly with Philip, right? Mm. And things have been bad with Boniface, RIP. Fun fact too, just before we get off of Boniface, according to Dante, Boniface is in the eighth circle of hell. So,
hell yeah.
Yeah, so that'll like tell you a little bit about how he was viewed. But anyway, so like, so basically, Benedict is supposed to be a conciliatory candidate, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't necessarily like really go down that way. So Boniface VIII had excommunicated Philip for being difficult. And, very quickly, Benedict is like, no, I'm undoing that excommunicated, but I am going to excommunicate Philip the Fourth's like best friend, the minister who is, Guglielmo of, Nogelet. And also like, so the these guys are going to be excommunicated. Now, why were they excommunicated? Well, they were excommunicated because when Philip got angry with Pope Boniface VIII, he sent Philip to kidnap Pope Boniface VIII, and everybody beat the shit out of Boniface VIII, and he eventually died.
Jesus.
Which is very funny to me. That's very funny to me. He was, like, kidnapped and held prisoner for 3 days and just, like, beaten the fuck up. He was eventually, like, liberated by the forces of Cardinal Luca Frascetti. But then he, like, dies. And that's how you get Benedict XI, right? It's so funny. I love it. I love it so much.
It's so messy. So dramatic.
I like to refer to Pope Boniface VIII as Pope Boniface the Beatdown. That's what's funny for me. So Benedict then like is like, okay, look, I'm gonna not blame Philip for this, even though he ordered this, but like I'm afraid someone's gonna have to get excommunicated, and it's gonna be like your homie who kidnapped him and all the Italians. And Philip is like, now hang on, just like 1 minute.
Like, whoa. Nobody said anything about consequences.
Yeah, like basically, which is really quite funny. So basically then he like, but then he dies like, mm. and then people are like, okay, so everyone then is worried that Nogeret, Guillaume of Nogeret has like poisoned him.
Mm.
We don't really have, any evidence to say of that, but people are just kind of saying that. Okay. So then you get Clement V. Now, Clement V was elected in France, and he never even goes to Rome. He's just kind of like, no thanks. Like, he's like, I'm posting up and down here in the south of France, and this is where we are hanging out now. And now there are a couple of reasons for this. The first is that Rome is on fire, like, it's just a complete, like, there's basically civil war going on back and forth, and it's just kind of like not a very good place to be. The second bit is it's kind of like a nod to the French crown being like, 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 we're not doing anything. But at the same time, it's also kind of like, it's also a confusing one because it's also sort of like, well, part of the reason why they're posting up there is they're all like, we're keeping an eye on you. And so basically he's a big part of like, and like Clement is really, really kind of does whatever it is that, you know, the French king wants. He's super involved in the suppression of the, Templars. So like so it's just kind of like a big French vibe, right? Big French vibe. So it's kind of confusing about how this starts out, but when it starts out, it's not anti-popes right away. It's popes. Like, there are plenty of, there are plenty of Avignonese popes. So Clement V is a real piece of shit. You know, like, a lot of these guys are. I think that, like, poor little Benedict XI, you know, like, he's trying his best. He just dies. But, like, Pope Boniface VIII, a real piece of shit. Pope Clement V, a real piece of shit. Like, absolutely not good guys. You do not gotta hand it to them under any circumstances. But it's just kind of like this is like a very kind of like late 13th century, kind of early 14th century deal. And it expresses how politics was working at the time, right? Where like the French crown is incredibly important. Rome is on fire. You can't blame anyone for not necessarily wanting to live there. So they kind of take themselves off. And this starts, you know, we call this the Babylonian captivity. Right. But it features, you know, some guys I really like. Clement VI, interesting guy who I like. I like Urban V, you know, as I say. But then you kind of get the anti-popes after that. So basically, though, the thing about the Avignonese papacy is, unlike people like me who are cool and sexy, who kind of like the Avignonese papacy and are like, well, that seems fair enough. This didn't go down well at the time. And people were like, oh, come on. Like, it was really read, like, you're just dick riding for the French crown, which, like, probably the papacy shouldn't be doing that. So that's point A. Point B is that, oh, you're posting up in the south of France just because, like, Rome sucks. Well, guess what? You're the Pope. Nobody cares, right? Nobody cares.
You're supposed to live in squalor, you dipshit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, right? So they're like, well, why would you want to do that? And now, having said that, right, like, there are people who consider it, like, Urban V, like, goes back to Rome and, like, visits Rome. And so, Charles IV is constantly trying to get the popes to move back to Rome, for example. And everyone is kind of like, dude, this is, like, traditional. You should really be back there doing your thing. And the popes are like, no.
Like, I think not.
I will not do that, right? Until you eventually get to the late 14th century, which is when you start getting anti-popes. And now the first anti-pope is Clement VII. So basically, the way that this starts, I think we may have covered this before, but I can't necessarily remember. Basically, the way that this starts out is that the papacy is like, okay, well, that's it. We're going back to Rome or whatever. Like, we're going to do it, everybody. And everyone is like, hooray, we're doing it. And then they're like, and also a thing that we've really got to do is we have got to elect an Italian guy. And, like, preferably, we really need a Roman, right? And So basically, we need to like get someone in to be like, don't worry, we're not just dick riding the French crown. We've heard you all, like, whatever. Mm-hmm. So basically, and it's like Avignon is like considered to be particularly corrupt. I don't know why specifically. corrupt than Rome. Like, I don't really buy it, right?
Well, you're under the thumb of the French instead of, you know, yeah. I don't know, under the thumb of the Austrians or whatever, but, whoever it was.
Whoever, yeah, it's a, yeah. So basically, it's like you have the last Avignonese Pope, Gregory the 11th. He's like, okay, well, we're going back to Rome. We're doing it, everybody. But then, like, they go to and have Easter celebrations, and he's like, yeah, I'm peacing back out to Avignon. Fuck this shit. Which I think is quite funny. But then he dies in the Vatican. Right? Huh. And then, so everyone is like, okay, like, now is the moment, right? Because he died in the Vatican. Yeah. He's here. Let's go get, we're going to get a Roman. This is what's going to happen. And, like, the Romans start, like, moving, right? So basically, there is an election, and they elect this guy who becomes Pope Urban VI, who's called Bartolomeo Prignano, but he's not actually Roman. He was the Archbishop of Bari, and I think he's from Puglia. But everyone was just like, hooray, like an Italian guy. And they're like, don't look at this too quickly, okay? But he was a terrible fucking guy. Mm. Like, really bad guy. He was, like, really violent. Like, just a really bad dude. And basically, the cardinals who elected him are like, a bunch of them run away. They're like, I'm getting out of here. Mm. I'm going back to Avignon. And they kind of also say that, like, basically, they were pressured into electing him. And that they were, like, worried of violence if they didn't do it. And so they're like, we want a do-over. They run off they go to Agnani. And they elect Robert of Geneva, who becomes Pope Clement VII. And this is in 1378. And so they're like, okay, look, this whole Urban VI thing, that's invalid. We just didn't want to get killed by a bunch of Romans. And this guy sucks. And Clement VII basically just goes back to Avignon, and then that is how you get the Avignonese papacy. Bunch of people shake down, and they're like, you know what? Fair enough. Like, Joanna of Naples, she supports Avignon. Obviously, the French support Avignon. And then you just kind of, like, have a bunch of a shakedown of, like, who is going to support Avignon versus who's going to support Rome based on what everybody's political alliances are.
Yeah.
So, like... it's quite funny because, like, you get, for example, like, Scotland supports, Avignon,
yeah.
Right? But England supports, Rome, right?
Yeah.
And, like, things of this nature. So you have kind of, like, all of the various, noble people will just kind of, like, pick based on, like, what is best for them, right?
Yeah.
So, like... Interestingly, the Holy Roman Empire, they're kind of like, like back and forth with it. It's like sometimes they support one, sometimes they support the other because they're like, oh, we used to this. We used to this two pope shit. Like, I don't even care about this at all.
Yeah, it's so cute you guys are doing this now. We did this like a couple hundred years ago. This is cute. You guys are cute.
That's nice, right? But then like France, like most of what is now Spain, at Naples, and Scotland, they're all like, they stick with Avignon. And then it's like England, Ireland, like what is kind of now Northern Italy, Poland, Hungary, Sweden, Denmark. They all go and stick with Rome. So this goes on forever and ever and ever. We've been over this before. Definitely. We've talked about three pope time. When they're like, well, let's elect a third pope. And then,
yeah.
And then you two say you'll step down. And then they're like, no.
They're like, yeah, let's elect a new one in Pisa. Yeah, sure, why not? Let's do that.
Yeah, but it's you kind of have to talk about this because, you know, it is bound up with all this heretical stuff because, you know, it's Clement VI who, you know, was like in bed with the French king that allows you to kind of like allows the understanding that maybe these things can kind of happen, you know, and it's all really bound up in this incredibly complex, like, this is, there's a reason why this is, like, my favorite era of medieval history, is it's just so complex, like, all of the allegiances are on the table, everything is up in the air, and I just think it's absolutely fascinating, and, we can go on like this for quite some time. I will never not talk about anti-popes, but there's just so much, there's so much to say, right? So, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess there's obvious, but, like, how did this specifically, like, the moving to France and then, you know, the three churches and everything, how did that harm the church, like, as an institution?
So it really, really does. And, you know, so you can kind of see this. Like, let's talk about Maya guys once again. Let's talk about Czech people in order to show how this happens. So, Miljic, big reformer, big guy on reform. He just wants the papacy to go back to Rome, and that's all he wants, right? And he's writing to Pope Urban V and being like, please, how about now, please?
What about this? Nope.
And anyway, it doesn't happen. Good for him. He dies in Avignon because he gets in trouble. There's a guy who comes after him who is arguably more famous, Matveyev Yanov. And Matveyev Yanov is, again, a reformer, again, really obsessed with Antichrist, a lot like Miljic in a lot of ways, except he's not as clever, in my opinion. He is constantly like, oh, see, and now there's two popes. Right? And it's
all, look, you gone and done.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it for a lot of people gets interpreted as a sign of the end times. Where it was, so, you know, because there is a really easy way of kind of like identifying this as like the actions of Antichrist, for example. Yeah. You know, like this splitting the church in two, having two popes. It's like, well, how can anyone take this seriously as like, oh, this is a definitively holy organization that solely exists to represent the wishes of God on earth, right? How could that possibly be true when you've got like two popes and then the third pope, then the Pisan pope, shout out. I think he's an Alexander off the top of that. We love the Pisan pope. So like how can we possibly look at this organization as having the best interests of Christendom at its heart when you see individuals such as this who are clearly only into it for power? Right. Mm-hmm. You know, because, you know, like the whole Pisan Pope gambit should have worked if what everybody wanted was just, you know, what was best for Christendom.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen. And like, you know, the last Avignonese Pope dies in Avignon. But this all gets shored up at the Council of Constance.
Yeah.
Which kills my boy Jan. R.I.P. Jan Hus.
They love to do just a whole bunch of shit. They were like, all right, Council of Constance. We're getting rid of Avignon and Pisa. Also, Miljic is getting got, or, you know, Jan Hus is getting got.
Exactly. So it's like, basically, they kind of like, they end the Western Schism. And they basically, they're like, okay, we're electing Pope Martin V. And he, they are like, we're deposing / accepting the resignations of the other papal claimants. And we're electing Pope Martin V. Now, having said this, Avignonese guy is like, no, and goes back to Avignon, but everyone just ignores him. and they're like, fine. And he dies. The Pisan Pope, John. Yeah, it wasn't Alexander, it was John. John is like, he's one of the ones who convoked it. And he's like, yep, absolutely. Like, I'll step back. That sounds good. And then Pope Gregory the 12th, who was the Roman Pope, was like, yep, that's absolutely fine. And then they get Pope Martin V in there. The Avignonese guy dies. And at this point in time, the Avignonese faction are like, we're not going to get away with this, are we? We're not going to get away with it. And by this time, the church wants to start killing Hussites. So everyone is kind of like, we need to focus up because there's bigger fish to fry. So they basically are like, okay, yeah, we're all getting behind Martin. Which is, you know, kind of a shame because I love this period. But I love this period because, you know, all the things that people are complaining about, I'm like, yeah, that's right. Just show the world who you are. And I really dig that. So, you know, plus also I love Heresy.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, anti-popes, fun as hell. Love the third pope. Love that guy just coming in. You know, we get an extra one from a random place.
Yeah.
Love that shit. Love the hidden popes. You know, good stuff. Good stuff. We are definitely not getting to John Wycliffe today, but before we go,
yeah,
it's the Black Death. We've talked about the Black Death a few times, a couple of episodes on it, talked about it during the Materialism series. You guys know the drill.
Yeah.
Flees off the boat flees off, you know, somewhere in Asia, spread throughout the rest of, Eurasia and... Yeah. Or Afro-Eurasia, rather. And, it decimates mostly Europe. It gets a little bit of Asia, a little bit of Africa, mostly Europe. And kills anywhere 15 to 40% of the people on Earth at the time, given various estimates. Eleanor, how badly does this cataclysmic event fuck up the church?
Oh, it really does, because people are like, oh, so you're so holy. Why is everyone dying now? Why is God mad at us?
Yeah.
Right? And the obvious answer to this, as far as you ask them, is because you suck. Like, and it's very funny because, you know, I talk about this at length and over, because the church is like, no, God's killing us all because you suck.
No, it's nothing to do with us. We're just a humble institution. We've never done anything wrong.
Exactly.
It's you. You poor motherfuckers.
Yeah, and it's like you, if you would stop dressing sexy, then, you know, none of this would be happening right now. But, oh, no, you got to wear the pointy shoes. And, like, you know, so, and that's basically, like, the church's answer. And a lot of people interpret this as being that God is angry with the world, and more specifically with the church, especially for being such a worldly institution and having all that money, right? Mm. Which is part of, like, the anger at Avignon. And, like, you know, well, you're all living fine over in Avignon. And, like, God hates that, and he wants you to, like, move back into, like, the fucked up pile of flaming dog shit that is Rome. So, like, that's why he's killing us now.
I just love how Rome was, like, an absolute shithole from, like...
Really was.
From, like, even before the Western Roman Empire fell until, like, the end of the Middle Ages, everyone was just like, I don't want to be in Rome. Is there another swamp I can go to?
Exactly. Like, I mean, it's real easy to die of malaria out there, I'm telling you, man. Like, Jesus. So, yeah, like, it is quite funny, right, where basically people... You know, if what they're saying is that, you know, this can only be divine because it's so cataclysmic in terms of the death toll and everything, then, well, whose job was it to be looking after the divinity-ness? Bang. It's got to be those guys. So, and then when you got the split, that does not help, right? And it's like, again... This cannot possibly be good, right? So you see around this point, like, you know, like, again, Milich, like, brings this up. He's all like, you know, well, there's rather a lot of Black Death going around. Seems like God's pissed, right? Which is funny because we don't have as much in Bohemia for question mark. But, but which is hilarious because he's like, see, God loves Charles IV. He's a dick writer too, but, you know, like... It's very funny. It's very good.
I love it. That's good stuff. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. Like, you know, there's like one guy dying and he sees a guy dying of the Black Plague on the street. He's like, fuck, I got to go get Charles. What's he doing now?
Yeah, right. Like and it's just like, please, like, can't Charles rule everything so that, like, God will spare us all? Like, this is Milich's answer. Like, Milich's answer is that Urban V needs to, like, get together a big conclave and... like tell everyone to knock it off with sex pesting and having money, and also Charles
well IV, I mean, he's right about that.
Yeah, and then, like, Charles IV needs to, like, be involved in that and needs to have, like, and the popes are like, all right, like, he's all like, P.S. I am not a crank, you know.
like shut the fuck up, Jan, like, leave us alone.
nobody cares, but it's very funny. But you know,
No, I was just going to say, like, did he, I'll ask it next time. Sorry. It was a Jan Milic question. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, like, but the point is that this is just like, you can see how it opens you up to criticism. And the church was already open to criticism, you know, which is why you have people like the Fraticelli, you know, which is why you got Franciscans in the first place. These people existed specifically because people were like, the church shouldn't be so highfalutin and shouldn't have this much money. And then when bad things start happening, and when you've got multiple popes, all it does is prove these guys right. Right. So there's a long tradition of this within the church, and the Black Death and the Great Schism are basically like two of the big, the world is ending, we are fucked kind of things in the minds of medieval Christians, for sure.
And we've skipped around a little bit in time here, but the Black Death happens in the middle of the Avignon Papacy, about 1346 to 1353, and the Western Schism or the Great Schism doesn't really start up until like the 1370s. So yeah, like Eleanor is saying, you get the papacy in Avignon, and they're acting all rich and snooty, and then you get the Black Death, and then you get the schism and two popes and then three popes, you know, and yeah, you could just see how these people might be like, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. The world is ending.
We are fucked. Right. Because like, who do you look for? Where does one, you know, get spiritual succor in these circumstances? Yeah. Right. Which really explains, when you think about it, it explains the Hussites, it explains...
No, yeah, it, you know, does completely.
Where you're just like, oh yeah, well, like, here's some guys who are like, see that institution? That is fucked. And you're like, you know, it explains the Wycliffe, like the Lollards and Wycliffe, and, you know, all the guys that we're going to get to later. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think there's a... I think the fact that it's so open, and you could see how pronounced the thing is, and it was so pronounced that it was even obvious to, like, the peasants who were, like, temperamentally already really on the side of, you know, their lords and were really, really like this hierarchical thing. Like, even they're able to see, yeah, this system is fucked. There is a huge fucking problem here. And when you have something laid bare like that, it creates peasant rebellions and heretical movements and reformations, I guess.
They
get there. I think the Black Death is so interesting for that, because it really is, it's like just this large scale, like the wool falls off from people's eyes, you know, the scales fall off of their eyes, to use a biblical metaphor. And they're able to see, oh fuck, the church is actually really bad. And now, I mean, the response to that varies from person to person. Some people obviously go, you know, for the Reformation aspect. Some people are like, no, we can rebuild, we can, you know, change the church. And, you know, then some people do the cognitive dissonance thing and they're like, no, everything's fine. And yeah, I find that really interesting. But before we go today, we've talked about them a few times. The Black Death created them. Eleanor, who are the flagellants, and why the church is kind of okay with them for a little while, and then
they're not. So the flagellants are especially big in the Low Countries and in the German speaking lands, and they are people who are like, well, if God is punishing us all with the Black Death for our sins, why don't we physically punish ourselves? And then
this is a better reaction than what the church did, like, in my opinion.
Yeah, like, and then, like, it makes like a logical sense. We're like, we'll just get out in front of it. We're going to beat ourselves. Yep. Like, that's what's going to happen. And at first, the church is like, sure, bro.
Yeah, great. Go for it, man.
Like, yeah, that like makes sense. And they kind of like go from town to town. They strip themselves to the waist. They beat themselves. Oftentimes, they like throw themselves on the ground repeatedly. Like sometimes it's like 32 times, so that it's like the number of years that Jesus was alive, you know, things like that. They do a lot of magic number stuff. This is all well and good, and people really quite like it for a while, until they start preaching.
And then they shouldn't have done it.
They shouldn't have done it. And the church is immediately,
they should have just kept beating themselves with the little cracked tail with glass beads or whatever on the end of it. Yep,
and then immediately they start preaching, and the church is like, now hang on just a goddamn minute, because, you know, again, this is the problem with the Bagards, this is the problem with Beguines, this is the problem with the Fraticelli. It's like people who are preaching who shouldn't be, and like, you are not qualified to preach. And so then they get this reputation for being heretics, and then everyone starts like interpreting everything they do than as evil. So it's like the fact that they like travel in mixed groups and sleep in the woods. At first that was like, oh, they're so holy and apostolic. And then it was like, you having orgies? You having forest orgies? Is that what you're doing?
The woods orgy?
The woods orgy. Is that why you're stripping to the waist? Because you're going to have an orgy? You know, and so there's like a lot of this that goes on. And interestingly, like the church is like, we're about to crack down on these MFers. And then they just kind of like dissipate. It's kind of like, I think that they were just like, the church coming down on me as a heretic is one more thing I don't need. In the middle of it all. And so it's quite interesting where it's like they're incredibly popular. There's a ton of them really quickly. They go from being accepted to being heretical really, really quickly, and then they disappear. So it's like we don't see like big executions of them or anything like that. They just kind of like, oh, fuck it. Yeah, it's quite interesting. Yeah. So they're a really cool group of people. I love them.
that is very interesting that they just like, not only that they just went away, like almost like they didn't have like a centralized thesis or like doctrine built out around themselves. It was just like a response to this horrific condition. And then, you know, it got bigger and bigger and it kind of got out of hand, at least according to the church. And then, you know, they were like, knock it off. The church was like, knock it off. And they're like, Like, I mean, I was beating myself, but the world's still here, you know, not dead yet. Maybe God saved it, you know, like it just, yeah, that's wild. That's very, different from every other thing that we have. Like, you know, some of these, like we talked about, you know, they're still, you know, they're still around. They're still, you know, I forget what you called them.
Beggars and Beguines.
Yeah. No. The thing
where
Beguinage.
There we go. Yeah, sorry.
You know, no. That stuff is still around, and you know, we talked, I think, about the Waldensians last time, and they're still like a version of them is still around, and these guys are just like, you know what? You're right. This is getting a little on the edge. Not really a heretic. I'm just gonna go back and mend the wounded flesh on my back.
Mm-hmm,
I
guess.
It's wild. Yep. Yeah, so that's a long episode for today. But next time we will come back and we'll talk all about John Wycliffe, like I said.
Woo!
And then get into a bunch of Czech guys.
Czechs.
Why the church was so mad. So mad.
Okay, you know, they hate to see
Jan Hus and why he wanted to die so much.
You know what? Like they hate to see a player winning. That's all.
They hate to see a Czech man thrive.
That is. They do.
They do. They hate it. Yep. So, we'll be back with that next time. We will get the info on the Knight's Tale live stream
out
to everyone. Patrons, look forward to that. Again, thank you so much for listening. Check out the Patreon. Check us out on Twitter. You know the deal. Eleanor, where can people find your work in 2023? And I believe you have a book coming out
soon.
I
do. In 2 weeks, my book will be out.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, the Once and Future Sex. It will be out in 2 weeks, which is, I'm going to have to figure, I don't even know how I'm going to get a copy of this to you, Luke. I'm going to figure it out. anyway, but it's going to be out in 2 weeks. Please purchase it from wherever good books are sold. Even if you buy it from the worst retailer on earth, I'm not going to be mad, provided you please write a review and say, oh, Eleanor is so great and I would like to kiss her, because that helps sell books, apparently. So that's good. As always, you can find me dicking around on Twitter at Going Medieval. And the blog is going-medieval.com. When I'm off of Christmas break officially next week, I'm writing something for it. I'm going to write about Andrew Tate and sex trafficking and things of this nature, and how you should buy my book. So that should be good. So yeah, check that out. I appreciate it.
Hell yeah. Buy Eleanor's book, or I'll be mad at you.
Yeah.
Me specifically, I'll be mad at you. Yep. My name is Luke. Luke is amazing on Twitter. You can find my old show, People's History of the Old Republic. It's about Star Wars. You can find it wherever you're listening to this if you just can't get enough of the mellifluous sound of my voice. Anyway, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.